Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. I'm your host, Lauren Corman. I'm here with a couple of good friends. Wendy, as always, is now doing the music, and also David is in studio today. And I always say this, but it's always true. I think we have a really exciting show lined up. We're going to be speaking with Paul Shapiro, and he is the campaign coordinator for a Washington-based animal rights group called Compassion Over Killing, or COK. And in particular, we're going to be talking with him about a recent COK investigation in which some members from that group went to a factory farm, so-called laying hen factory farm, and openly took out 10 laying hens. And so this is a bit of a different strategy in terms of the animal rights movement, which in terms of doing rescues sometimes will go about it in more anonymous ways, and they were very open about going in and not disguising themselves and also openly taking out the birds and documenting those conditions and then having resulting press releases from that. So it's a very exciting strategy. It seems to be making a lot of waves, which is great. And so we're going to come back and speak with Paul about that initiative. And yeah, you're listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5. Paul, are you on the line?
I am indeed.
Great. Thank you for being here today.
No, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
So I assume a lot of people do know about this group, but for people who are unaware about what the group does in general, the type of background information probably would be good to give right now.
Sure. COK is an animal advocacy organization based in Washington, D.C. Our main function lies in conducting undercover investigations at factory farms and livestock auctions, but we also do a lot of community outreach as well. For example, every Thursday and Friday evening in the nation's capital in the U.S., we tour our FaunaVision van, a mobile theater, through the streets of D.C., showing slaughterhouse and factory farm footage and distributing free vegetarian starter kits to anybody who wants them. We also have an exhibit set up weekly on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., called Factory Farming in America, which really exposes the misery that animals who we eat endure before they end up going to the slaughterhouse. So we are part investigative and part outreach.
And do you focus then strictly on animals in agriculture, or do you have other initiatives as well?
The bulk of our work does focus on animals in agriculture, mainly because they represent the overwhelming majority of the animals who are killed every single year. In fact, more than 99%, not just the majority, more than 99% of the animals killed for human consumption every year die to be eaten. So we do focus the majority of our resources on those animals, but we also have other animal advocacy campaigns, such as campaigning against the use of animals in circuses, campaigning against the fur industry, and so on. But our primary function is working to promote vegetarianism.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that COK is getting increasingly known for is the open rescues that you've been involved with. We're going to talk about the specifics of the recent investigation, but if you could tell us sort of the background or the concept of an open rescue, that would be great.
Sure. We've been trying to popularize this tactic known as open rescue for about 18 months now, and it seems to be working fairly well. Unlike other type of animal rescues where those involved go to great lengths to mask their identity, whether it be by not videotaping the event or whether it be by wearing a mask, the exact opposite is true with open rescues, where not only do we take no measures to hide our identity when rescuing animals, we actually go to great lengths to make sure we document it every single step of the way and then turn over all of the evidence to the authorities and to the media after we're done. So, for example, we've now conducted 3 open rescues in the last 18 months at egg factory farms in the United States, mm-hmm. Actually all 3 of them in the state of Maryland, rescuing 28 birds, and each time the news of these rescues has been broadcast far and wide, not just on our website, which is cok.net, but also by papers like the Washington Post, the Baltimore Sun, the New York Times, USA Today, the San Francisco Chronicle, CNN. So these open rescues really generate a lot of publicity because it makes for a great story. People who are rescuing animals and are fully admitting it, we're mm-hmm. going out and we're taking responsibility for the action. And yet, despite all of this press coverage and despite the fact that we send videos and photos of ourselves rescuing animals to the authorities even, and to the farms,
right.
No prosecution has ever occurred yet in the United States, and there have been two other open rescues as well, one of 14 hens and the other of 34 hens. So what we're seeing is a reluctance from the authorities to prosecute these cases, and the theory really is that that reluctance exists for a couple reasons, the first being that egg-laying hens, each one has very little value to the egg industry. These are spent hens most of the time, and they're just not that financially valuable. In fact, if they're toward the end of their laying cycle, they're actually have a negative value because these farmers have to pay to have renderers come and take them off of the farm. But also, these type of stories generate so much positive publicity for animals and against factory farmers that these factory farmers know by prosecuting us for taking what really amounts to pennies or sometimes just dollars worth of their so-called property, they're going to be making much greater trouble for themselves by exposing themselves to even greater negative publicity through a highly politicized trial. So, like I said, despite our pretty intense efforts to try to bring that type of situation about where we would be put on trial for conducting one of these investigations and open rescues, it hasn't happened yet. Now, of course, maybe it will happen someday, but so far, scores and scores of these birds have been rescued openly and nobody has suffered any consequences.
That's great. One of the things that strikes me about doing rescues is that there's both short-term and long-term impacts. And one of the things I just love about this type of strategy is that regardless of the type of long-term effects that hopefully people see and the type of activism that we do, you know, if you're writing a letter, you hope that it's going to have some kind of impact. But with this, you know that 28 birds are now living, and they're not in terrible, terrible suffering conditions.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fantastic point. As somebody who does a lot of work both in the office and also in the field, I take a lot of pleasure knowing that I can concretely say that I helped out animals in that, you know, a lot of the things that we do are kind of, in terms of animal advocacy, we may be trying to set up a time in the future when there will be less animal suffering. For example, trying to convince people to become vegetarian or trying to demonstrate against circuses, whereas you know your actions aren't going to impact animals today, but you're hoping that at some point in the future they will. With working directly with animals, whether it be doing open rescue or whether it be doing something else hands-on with animals like shelter work, you know that you're having a concrete physical impact on the life of an animal, and really it couldn't be any more dramatic when we're talking about factory farmed hens who really have probably the most miserable life I could ever imagine. These hens are crammed so tightly in cages that they can't flap their wings. They live in windowless sheds, so they never see sunlight. They're suspended on wire mesh cages above thousands of pounds of their own excrement in massive manure pits. I mean, if you can imagine what it would be like to never touch earth, never lift your arms, and never see sunlight, that's only part of what these hens have to go through. The industry accepts a mortality rate of up to 11% of these hens, so they know that the stress of living that type of life is going to kill up to 11% of those birds, which leaves those survivors to live, sleep, and eat on top of decomposing corpses. Some of these hens become immobilized in the wires of their cages, forcing them to die from dehydration just inches away from water. I mean, it's hard to imagine a worse life than that of an egg-laying hen. So to see these 28 birds who we have rescued and then others who other groups who have conducted open rescues have rescued, to see them go free, to watch them touch earth for the first time, to see them feel sunlight on their back for the first time, really is a moving experience, and it's definitely something that will easily ensure that you'll never eat another egg again in your entire life.
Right. Then there's so many things, too, like with looking at pictures or even videotapes that don't even begin to describe what it's actually like to be there amongst the noise and the smell and the ammonia. So it's I would imagine, considering the incredible suffering that takes place, that it's quite difficult to figure out which birds to take. How does COK do that?
Yeah, that's a tough issue. I mean, most of these farms have hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of birds on the premises. So, you know, you really are making life and death decisions for those birds. Of course, they're all going to die anyway, so no matter who you rescue, you'll be doing something good. But with us, you know, there's a few different considerations that we try to make. First, who is in need the most? For example, if a bird looks like she has a broken wing and it looks like she's not going to fare too well, or if a bird is immobilized in the wires of her cage but is not yet dead, those are birds who we look for rescue. But we also want to make sure that we rescue birds who have a good chance of surviving, because a lot of the times these birds are so sick, their bodies are so stressed, that going through that type of a remarkable change so quickly can really do them in. So you want to find birds who need help more than others, but yet who aren't in so bad of a shape that they're going to die from the stress of being transported, for example, away from the farm.
Mm-hmm. How do you respond to people that criticize COK for sort of highlighting the worst of the worst? It seems like part of the strategy of this organization is to show that it really is an overall pattern. Mm. Have you been criticized for that, that, you know, that you're documenting the very worst conditions out there?
Well, the egg industry has certainly accused us of finding what they call bad seeds or bad apples of the egg industry to expose. So what we've done is we're picking major commercial egg producers and just walking into their farms. And I'll tell you, I've been to a lot of these egg farms. They all look the same. Mm-hmm. I wish that I could say that what we're documenting is the worst of the worst, but I would be lying if I said that. Animal abuse is the standard. It's the norm in the egg industry. Every single hen who lives in a factory farm will never see sunlight, touch earth, or flap her wings. That's animal cruelty, and it would be illegal, at least we would hope that there would be prosecution if that type of cruelty was forced on dogs or cats. Yet because they're birds, we allow it to happen, and we fund it when we sit down to eat a meal that includes eggs. So again, I wish that I could say that what we're documenting was the exception and not the rule, but that's really not the case. And if you want to see these photos for yourself, just go to our website, cok.net, and click on the photo gallery for the recent investigation and look at that type of abuse, look at that type of misery these birds are enduring, and then think about whether or not what we are going to be willing to do to lend a hand to them.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk a little bit about legislation? I know that Canada is different than the United States, and the states will differ from state to state. And my understanding is that in some states that birds aren't even considered animals underneath the Welfare Act that exists right now.
Well, in the United States, the Animal Welfare Act specifically excludes farm animals. So the Animal Welfare Act that we have in the United States has absolutely no bearing whatsoever on farm animals. And it's true, the Animal Welfare Act does say that birds are not classified as animals, and they're referring to birds who are being used in vivisection laboratories. So, and the same goes for rats and mice. So rats, mice, and birds in the United States, if they're living in a lab, do not have any protection whatsoever. Not to say that the Animal Welfare Act really offers that much protection
right.
to other animals anyway, but these animals have literally nothing. Now, in terms of farm animals, we do have the Humane Slaughter Act, which was passed in the 1950s in the United States, and is pretty much largely ignored by slaughterhouses. I can't tell you how many United States Department of Agriculture inspectors have written about what a complete joke this Humane Slaughter Act is, because it's just routinely ignored and there's no punishment for slaughterhouses that are ignoring it. Now, at the same time, though, birds, as in the Animal Welfare Act, birds who are being slaughtered are excluded from the Humane Slaughter Act, even though they represent more than 85% of the animals dying in slaughterhouses. They are completely excluded, so there's no regulations for them whatsoever. And finally, in terms of legislation for farm animals in the United States who live on farms as opposed to when they go to slaughter, mm-hmm. there isn't a single law at all out there specifically designed to protect farm animals. Each state does have a specific cruelty statute, but most of them exempt either farm animals or at least standard industry practices. So this November was the first time any state enacted a law specifically to protect farm animals while on the farm, where we saw the state of Florida pass legislation to ban the use of gestation crates for pregnant pigs. That law, however, won't go into effect for another 5 years. So until then, presumably, we will still have no laws protecting animals while they're on farms.
Right. That really, those facts really challenge, I think, one of the stereotypes that's out there that if things were really that bad, something would have been done about them, which is something that I get quite often when I talk about these issues.
Yeah, it's a sad situation, but it couldn't be more true that there just aren't any laws that are out there to protect farm animals.
Mm-hmm.
And a big part of the reason for that is because animals don't vote. Animals are not a constituent for politicians. And for the most part, at least until very recently in America, the animal advocacy movement has not really been that political. We've focused a lot of our attention trying to get publicity, trying to change consumer habits, but not that much energy until just the last year or two has been really put into fighting for legislation to protect animals.
Mm-hmm. So how has the industry responded to this type of investigation or this type of information that groups like yourselves are putting out there?
The industry has taken a pretty interesting response, which is mainly to ignore it for right now. They have really tried to sweep things under the rug. You know, you see in egg industry trade journals like Egg Industry Magazine, they do talk about it. In fact, they recently ran an interview with myself and several other animal advocates recently in not this latest issue, but the one past, I believe, October 2002. Asking what type of changes we would like to be seen, we'd like to see within the egg industry. But they really haven't done that much. The United Egg Producers, an industry trade group in the United States, has recently implemented what they call new welfare standards for egg-laying hens in the U.S. And in short, this is just the same old cruelty, but a new deception. They are mandating that egg producers increase cage space per bird to 67 square inches as opposed to the norm today, which is 50. Now, McDonald's has already gone further than this, so they're not even approaching what McDonald's has done, which is 72 square inches. But, I mean, it is true, 67 square inches is better than 50. But really, the reason why I say it's the same cruelty with a new deception is because not only are they not going as far as McDonald's, McDonald's required immediate implementation, whereas the United Egg Producers have a six-year phase-in for this new program. But just to give a quick idea of what type of space we're talking about, a egg-laying hen requires about 290 square inches to flap her wings. And we're talking about a difference of either 67 or 72. So merely to flap her wings, she needs 290 square inches, and the egg industry is saying that their so-called reform is going to bring it up to 67. I mean, it's a complete joke, and it just shows how completely unwilling they are to take the welfare of these birds seriously. And I think that the only humane thing for the rest of us to do is just to simply not eat eggs, because we cannot count on the egg industry to really do anything except for try to get away with doing as little as physically possible.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that is going to be even more sickening is that egg producers who do go up to the 67 square inches are going to be able to label their eggs with a new certification logo that says Animal Care Certified.
And as we heard earlier in the interview, that it's really much more than just being cramped within these cages. These animals are forced to stand on wire cages or on the wire floors, and there's the ammonia, there's all the manure everywhere, there's just the noise, there's lack of airflow, there's lack of sunlight, there's all these other issues that wouldn't be cured by making a bigger cage.
Sure. Cage space is only one of the many issues involved with welfare in the egg industry. And to think that increasing it up to 67 would take care of all those other problems really would not be realistic.
Mm-hmm. I take your view as well about eggs and not consuming eggs, but I think for a lot of people, they see free-range eggs as being sort of the best option for them. And I know in Canada right now there's not a lot of agreement on what constitutes free-range or free-run eggs. So can you talk a little bit about what you know in the United States about free-range or free-run eggs?
Sure. Well, free range is really a misnomer, at least in the United States, in that there's no federal regulation in terms of defining what it means, and there certainly is no inspection program to ensure that egg farms labeling their products so-called free range are actually doing anything differently. But some of the problems that we have in the U.S. with free range include the following. Eggs labeled free range oftentimes don't come from hens who lived in battery cages, but rather they lived on the floor, still in a warehouse, but they live on the ground in their own excrement. And so these hens who are free range, so-called, actually have a higher mortality rate. More of them are dying than in battery cages because they're living in their own excrement, as opposed to those in battery cages who are suspended above their excrement.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's a lot of different problems with it, but it's interesting. The editor of Egg Industry Magazine, an industry trade journal, Charlie Olentine, recently had an editorial in which he said, quote, "Just because it says free-range does not mean that it is welfare-friendly." And I think that he sums it up perfectly right there. Free-range really should not be that much of an assurance to anybody. If we think about other types of animal products that are labeled free-range, for example, let's take beef. Sure, these cows might be living in a pasture. However, they're still going to be branded. They're still going to be castrated, dehorned, sometimes even detailed with no painkiller. I mean, imagine castrating an animal without painkiller. I mean, can you think of something more cruel to do? And yet that's still considered free range. And of course, they're all still going to the same slaughterhouses where they're going to be strung upside down by one or two legs and have their throats slit and bleed to death. I mean, there's still a lot of violence and a lot of bloodshed involved in consuming animal products free range or factory farm. And I'm not going to deny that you're probably doing less harm by buying free range, but it's really a matter of being inhumane and less inhumane rather than humane or humane. The best thing to do for animals is simply to stop eating them. If you're interested in getting a free vegetarian starter guide, just give us a call at 1-866-MEAT-FREE or visit us online at tryveg.com.
Mm-hmm. Paul, I wanted to address the issue about where did the hens go? And I know that you probably don't want to tell us exactly where, but how are homes found for the rescued hens?
Sure. Well, yeah, you're certainly right that we don't disclose the locations where they go to. While we are more than willing to deal with any consequences that might come from openly rescuing animals, we are not willing for them to go back to factory farms. So we certainly don't discuss specific locations. However, the types of places where we like to put hens, the type of places we like to put hens are places where they can lead normal bird lives, where they can have access to both the indoors and the outdoors, where they will be with other hens, hopefully those who came from the same factory farm that they came from. They'll have a place to roost. They'll have a place to nest. They'll have a place to sunbathe and dust bathe. And they'll have enough land that they can really spend a lot of the time just wandering and foraging and doing the things that chickens like to do. They are not going to be equipped for somebody to keep as you might keep a dog or a cat, but where they would be more appropriately placed would be in a place where they have land to roam over and where they're going to be safe from predators and the weather elements, too.
Mm-hmm. I know from reading various other rescues with the Animal Liberation Front that sometimes it's difficult for activists who are taking so-called domesticated animals out of cages because there is the issue always of trying to find them a home, whereas if you're releasing mink or something like that, they can sometimes just go out into the wild.
Yeah, it's certainly true that you don't want to be releasing chickens into the wild, especially those who have lived in a cage their entire lives.
Right.
they're not going to fend well, and they would probably die. So I wouldn't recommend that at all.
Mm-hmm.
What I would recommend is looking to places where they have experience taking care of chickens, where they have experience with farm animals in general, and where they can lead a good life for the chickens, who can really forage and sunbathe and do all the types of things that they really enjoy doing.
Mm-hmm. And of course that stands in stark contrast to how that they're living before they're rescued. You had mentioned before the break about spent hens, and I'm not sure if everybody would know what that is, and also if you could describe that as well as what forced molting is, and maybe talk a little bit about the average lifespan of a chicken within a factory farm as opposed to how they would be living if they could live out their lives without being spotted at the end of it.
Sure.
So that's three questions, I realize. So maybe the spent hen part could be the first part of it.
Sure. A spent hen refers to a hen who has lived out her productive life. Now, normally, birds in the wild don't ever become spent, but that's because they're on a more natural laying cycle. Chickens, maybe 50 years ago in this country, laid on average 40 or 50 eggs a year, but we've bred them to lay so many now that they're actually laying well over 200 eggs a year. This takes an enormous toll on their bodies and means that they start losing their productivity at around 1 to 2 years, at which point they are either rendered or slaughtered. And so spent hen refers to a hen who is no longer that productive, at least not profitable enough for the egg industry to keep around. Their average lifespan in a factory farm, they'll be killed anywhere between 1 and 2 years, whereas if chickens are allowed to lead their lives more naturally, they can live even up to a decade. So we're killing them at only a fraction of their lifespan just to have their eggs. Yet, you know, we oftentimes think of egg-laying hens not really as being killed because they're only laying eggs, when the reality is that indeed they are being killed. If they're going to be rendered, they're going to be gassed to death by the thousands. And if they're going to be slaughtered, they'll end up being killed just like the other birds who we eat, going to a slaughterhouse, being shackled upside down, and having their throat slit.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe forced molting, which is, I'm not quite sure what it's, where the United States is in terms of that practice. I know that it's been highly contested in both Canada and the U.S. Maybe first describe what that process is and then how widespread it is. That would be great.
Forced molting is the process by which the egg industry induces a new laying egg cycle for these birds. So naturally, they will not be laying eggs all year round. They go through what's called a molt, where they'll lose their feathers and stop producing eggs. But obviously, they're of no use to the egg industry sitting in cages if they're not laying eggs. So to speed up this process, they artificially induce a molt by force molting them, which right now means starving them. It means withholding food for probably about 7 to 10 days. And they know that some of the birds will end up dying from this, but it's still profitable to do because you have such less downtime from the birds. Right now, research is being done within the egg industry to come up with ways to force molt the birds without starving them, and they're primarily experimenting with different types of feeds to see if they can induce a molt by maybe doing a feed, giving them some feed that's deficient in this nutrient or something else like that. But right now, the majority of egg producers do practice forced molting. It is a highly contested practice because of the obvious cruelty involved in starving birds to get them to lay more eggs. And several fast food companies in the United States have now refused to buy eggs from producers who do use forced molting. The United Egg Producers, however, the industry trade, their new so-called reforms do not prohibit forced molting at all.
Hmm. Wow. And also another thing that we didn't talk about yet, which I was hoping we could go over, was about calcium depletion and bone breakage that is sometimes a result of having to produce so many eggs as well. That's part of the cruelty that's involved in the egg industry as well.
Yeah, as I mentioned, these hens are laying an extraordinarily high, an extraordinarily unnatural number of eggs every single year. And eggs, as you can probably guess, contain a lot of calcium in the shell. So it leaches a lot of calcium from their bones. And of course, they already are going to be more prone to osteoporosis from never exercising. You know, you can prevent osteoporosis, at least increase your chances of preventing it by doing a lot of weight-bearing exercise, like lifting weights or running or something else. But these birds, since they don't move, they're already going to have weak bones. And now because of all of this calcium leaving their body on a daily basis, they also are going to have even weaker bones from that process. So it's estimated that the overwhelming majority of these birds, by the time they're slaughtered, are going to have brittle, broken bones. And I've been in these sheds after they've cleared out the birds, after they've cleared them out for slaughter, and you look at these empty battery cages. There are legs still in them, wings still in them, sometimes even heads still in them. I mean, the process of removing them from their cages after their lifetime confined in them is pretty barbaric. And you can, as I said, you can evidence this just by looking at those cages and seeing all the limbs that have been left behind.
Mm-hmm. I was speaking to one slaughterhouse worker about a year and a half ago who said that, you know, even when they're trying to handle the birds as humanely as possible, that they're dealing with these birds coming at such a quick rate, and they're trying to take them before that the slaughterhouse out of the cages quite quickly, and that the bones will just shatter through even the handling process as well.
Yeah, they're extremely, extremely delicate and fragile after a lifetime of that type of abuse.
Mm-hmm. Just for people who may be tuning in now, what we're talking about is the egg industry in the United States, and we're interviewing Paul Shapiro, who is the campaign coordinator for Compassion Over Killing, and they were just involved with an investigation in which they took 10 birds from the Redbird egg farm in Maryland, and so we're talking about the conditions that are found there. Maybe we could talk a little bit about what the public response has been. You said that generally it's been quite positive. What have people said about learning about these types of conditions?
Certainly the media response has been extremely positive. All of these articles that are coming out focus on our allegation of routine cruelty within the egg industry and our plea to the public to not fund that type of animal cruelty by refusing to eat eggs. And as best as I can tell from the public is that most people are concerned about animal abuse.
Mm.
Most people do not want the animals we eat to be being tortured their entire lives. And so when they learn what actually happens to these animals, what type of misery they have to go through to get that egg on the plate, most people don't want to support it. Now, there can oftentimes be a disconnect between what the industry is doing and our own consumer habits, which is why it's important to reinforce this point that every time we spend a dollar, we are really voting about what type of a world we want to live in. Do we want to live in a world where birds are treated like mere commodities and are intensively confined for years on end with a life that is so riddled with suffering, it's hard to even comprehend what their existence must be like? Or do we want to live in a world where those who are too weak to defend themselves, like these birds and like other farm animals, are treated with respect, dignity, and compassion? So we can't just point our finger at the egg industry and say, hey, it's you guys who need to change. We need to point the finger back at ourselves and say, well, wait a minute, what can I do to remove my support for that type of animal abuse? What can I do to help these hens out, to help them out and give them a better life? And the number one answer is to stop eating eggs. And if you've already done that, then we can talk about doing a lot of other things, such as getting the word out, distributing literature, distributing vegetarian food to the public, conducting investigations and open rescues. There's a whole line of other things that we can do to offer some type of resistance to factory farming.
Mm-hmm. So what about, what kind of advice would you give somebody who'd be interested in undertaking that type of initiative?
Yeah, you know, there certainly are. There's a lot of advice and a lot of tips. These type of actions require an extraordinary amount of planning and an extraordinary amount of organization, and it would be hard to go into all of that on one radio show. So
mm-hmm.
what I'll do is I'll encourage people you are interested in engaging in that type of activity, to just email me at info@cok.net. That's info@cok.net. And just ask about advice for doing investigations in open rescues, because there's really a lot of logistical planning that needs to get done, and nobody should have to reinvent the wheel, so to speak.
Right.
We've done it. We have a lot of advice we're happy to offer, so don't hesitate to contact us.
Wendy actually asked during the break about whether or not the open rescue idea was built on a previous model that COK was drawing off of, or did this organization create this strategy?
No, Compassion Over Killing did not create the open rescue strategy. It was really founded in Australia by an activist named Patty Mark.
Mm-hmm.
She is an absolutely wonderful animal advocate. She's been conducting open rescues for nearly two decades now in Australia. She and her other colleagues in Australia have rescued hundreds of battery hens from the misery they endure at egg production facilities. And so in 1999, myself and some other United States animal advocates got a chance to hear Patty Mark speak at a conference in the state of Virginia. And after that, we all knew that that was going to be the next thing in the United States to try out to help factory-farmed animals was an open rescue. What really pushed us over the fence was watching the media coverage that Patty Mark routinely gets for her actions, where she's not painted as a criminal or as a terrorist or as anything else that you could think of negative that animal activists sometimes are accused of.
Mm-hmm.
Rather, the media treated her as a hero, as somebody who was going into places where animals were being abused and doing what she could to help them after having already contacted the authorities and waited for them to do something, seeing that the authorities weren't going to act. And then she went in, and she didn't hide the fact that she went in. She didn't try to conceal her identity. All she did was go in, videotape herself taking out some animals, show what the conditions were like, and then gave the tapes over to the press.
Mm-hmm.
So after seeing that type of coverage, we were certain that we wanted to at least try it out in the United States. So the first group to try it out was Compassionate Action for Animals in Minnesota. They rescued about 14 hens and ended up getting not that much press coverage, but no prosecution. So Compassion Over Killing tried it out next in May of 2001. And what happened after that was it was all history after that. I mean, it was a Washington Post exclusive. And then subsequent rescues by Mercy for Animals in Ohio, as well as Compassion Over Killing again, two more times in Maryland. And, you know, the press coverage has been unbelievable. Everything from the New York Times to the San Francisco Chronicle to CNN has covered these events. So it's a strategy that is still new in the United States, but is really starting to firmly establish itself, and I wouldn't expect to see it go away anytime soon.
That's great. I know with the Animal Liberation Front, which is a nonviolent group, or I guess you can't even call it a group, sets of individuals that will go undercover and rescue animals, but they're anonymous. I know that some people accuse them of actually working against animal rights goals because they're somehow not generating public support because they're breaking the law. And so it sounds like public opinion about these open rescues is actually quite the opposite of that, that people aren't dismissing it just because it's a so-called illegal activity.
Yeah, I do think that it's true that public reaction to an open rescue would be fairly different from a rescue that wasn't open.
Mm.
But, you know, there also might be different aims for these, whereas typically non-open rescues do tend to not be so concerned about what public reaction will be as much as they're concerned just with rescuing animal lives. Whereas an open rescue, the point is to not only rescue these animals, but also to do a great job of exposing the conditions that they're suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, you could still do that in a non-open rescue, but there's always going to be some problem in terms of people wondering why those who are involved aren't taking the responsibility for it. But that's not to to criticize those who rescue animals without it being open. I don't really think that these two activities ought to be competing as much as they can just supplement each
right.
other.
Definitely. So I have a general question for you, Paul, just about your own opinion about where you see the animal rights movement going, if you see any trends or where you picture the movement in 10 or 20 years.
Well, I'm a firm believer that we will be looking back maybe one or two generations down the line on the current ways that we treat animals today. We're going to be looking back on our treatment of animals today with the same revulsion and with the same horror that we presently look back on past atrocities right now. How soon that will be, I said maybe a generation or two, I don't really know, but I will say that we are moving relatively with light speed, and I'm saying this not as somebody who's known for being overly optimistic.
Okay.
If you think about how new the animal rights movement is, I mean, really, at least in the United States, just about two decades old. And look at what we've already done so far in terms of making a lot of headway into public awareness, into getting legislative protection for wildlife. Now we're starting to see farm animals come into play with the ballot initiative process that just happened last November in the state of Florida. We are really starting to see a lot of progress made. Just 5 years ago, for example, in the United States, nobody had ever been convicted of cruelty to a farm animal, ever.
Mm-hmm.
Now we've already seen three cases where it's happened in the United States. So we are starting to see a change in public consciousness, but in terms of overwhelming, dramatic changes in society's views and actions toward other animals, I can't really predict where we're going to be in 10 to 20 years, but what I can say is that I think it's going to be completely dependent on how much work animal advocates put into this movement. I oftentimes wonder when maybe 50 years down the line, what people will be asking me and other people who are involved today about what we did. We knew
right.
where these farms were. We knew how hellish the conditions for the animals were. What did we do to stop these atrocities? And I'd like to answer that I did everything that I possibly could. I'd like to feel that I really spent as much time and energy and resources as I possibly could have to try to end the horrible, horrible cruelty we're inflicting on other animals today. And I think that if enough of us will take this attitude and really dedicate ourselves to making the world a better place for other animals, that we'll start seeing a lot more dramatic changes sooner than we would have ever expected.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you could, now would be a good time to also give us some more information about how people can get involved with COK or with maybe other groups that you could recommend. I can give people information about Canadian groups if they want to write Animal Voices at CIUT-FM. But maybe if they're more interested in learning about COK, if you could give that information again, that would be great.
Sure, that would be fantastic. Please visit us online at www.cok.net. That's COK.net. If you want to check out our free vegetarian starter guide, just go to tryveg.com. That's tryveg.com. And I can't encourage you enough to also check out goveg.com. That's goveg.com. It's a fantastic vegetarian advocacy website. It has great ideas for ways to get active on behalf of farm animals, and a lot of other great information, videos, photographs, and everything else that you can check out on there. So that's what I would recommend, and I'll put in a plea to other animal advocates who are listening right now to consider where the majority of the animals who are suffering are right now. They're on factory farms, and they're in slaughterhouses. As I said at the beginning of this interview, more than 99%, not just the majority, more than 99% of the animals we kill die to be eaten. If we want to make significant change for other animals, we really need to be promoting vegetarianism with a lot more vigor. So get out there, get in the streets, promote vegetarianism. If you need literature, contact us again at COK.net, or also visit veganoutreach.org, another fantastic vegan advocacy organization. And get out there and do what we can to really help these animals out. Nobody else is out there they are the most abused yet the most ignored animals on the face of the planet are the animals we eat. So please do what you can, and we can make this world vegetarian a lot quicker.
Thanks, Paul, for being on the show today. I have to say, Compassion Over Killing is, for me, one of the most inspiring groups out there, and I look to you guys as an inspiration, and it helps keep me motivated, so I wanted to say thank you.
Oh, wow, thank you. That's a high compliment, and I really appreciate it. It means a lot. Again, visit cok.net. We'd love to hear from you.
And if you wanted to get more information about Canadian groups, you can always write us at animalvoices@ciut.fm.